Good morning. Is it Sunday? Is it Monday? Is it still Christmas? Is it New Year's? Yes, it's not Brendan O'Connor. Sounds a little bit like Philip Boucher Hayes. It is the confusing where the hell are we week. But let us take you gently by the hand and guide you somewhere in the direction of 2021 with newspaper front pages that are, for a change, filled with quite a lot of hope. Because we're in a very different place this week than where we were a week ago. We have a Brexit deal, and since yesterday we have a vaccine in the south of the island. So to the papers, Sunday Business Post leads on first vaccines to be given in nursing homes this Wednesday. Sunday Independent, delivery of hope. Mail on Sunday, dawn of hope. Sunday Times, kind of mixing the smooth with the rough. COVID vaccine arrives as daily cases hit a peak. Sunday Mirror, get the jab, says Christy Dignam. In a swipe at anti-vax campaigners, Christy, who beat a heroin addiction, said people will buy a gram of coke and stick it up their nose, yet they won't take the vaccine. It doesn't make sense. The Sun on Sunday leads with the needle has landed. And the Sunday World, I'll go to war with Kinahan. That's a lawyer in the US who's going to subpoena Daniel Kinahan in an alleged racketeering case. The British papers are really worth taking a closer look at today just to see how bumpy or smooth a ride the Brexit deal is going to get. The Sunday Telegraph, notoriously, obviously, a platform for whatever stray thought crosses Boris Johnson's mind, leads with big changes are coming for Britain, vows PM over a piece which suggests that the deal does have the support of most Brexiteers, but it only actually names two in the paper. The Sunday Times says the hardliners are prepared to back the deal, but the ERG is demanding that a full vote be delayed for 3 weeks so they can scrutinise it properly. And the Observer takes a lead that will leave fishermen here who are feeling betrayed scratching their heads, because over there they're saying fishing industry chiefs cry betrayal. In its editorial, the Observer says that the deal is no political triumph, no diplomatic feat. It will one day surely be regarded as one of the greatest ever deceits inflicted on the electorate. And the Sunday Express says Brexiteer Tories are close to backing an historical trade deal under the headline, the future is in our hands. Back to the Irish papers, some of the other front page stories worthy of note. The Sunday Indo is flying a political kite in its front page sidebar. We should explore reintroducing water charges. That's coming from a Green Party junior minister, Malcolm Noonan, in a piece which notably has no comment from Fianna Fáil or Fianna Gael in it. And below the fold of the Business Post, they are telling us that the government is expected to give the Brexit deal its go-ahead on Tuesday. That, folks, is 2 days from now, in case you have completely lost your place in the week. And the main picture in the Business Post front page is of Mary Lou McDonald, who is, according to Michael Brennan, telling Sinn Féin supporters to stop being pig ignorant on social media. From beneath an avalanche of wrapping paper, three newspaper reviewers have joined me now to wipe the brandy butter from their lips and let reality intrude again momentarily. Political journalist Lise Hand. How many calories did you manage to pack in the last 3 days, Lise?
I shudder to think. Literally every time I open my mouth, somebody was shoving a mince pie into it, or a turkey leg, or a Florentine, or something.
have a few harsh words with that somebody. I myself have managed to consume enough to not have to eat until March, which is going to be rather convenient. Irish Times consumer journalist Conor Pope. Conor, can you enjoy Christmas knowing as much as you know about what it is that you're unwrapping? Is it possible to have an ethical-free Christmas?
Absolutely. I just switch off entirely. And I ate about four, and I'm not joking, four full Christmas dinners. I have eaten four full Christmas dinners.
In the one day?
Or? No, since Christmas Day, Stephen's Day.
Since getting up this morning.
And I will probably go home and eat another one. And I don't mind it, because you know the way people say, oh, I don't like turkey. I love turkey. I love Brussels sprouts. I love all of that stuff. So this really
you
is...
You love Brussels sprouts?
Yes, yes.
Leave this studio now. Leave this studio now.
If I was to cook you my Brussels sprouts, you'd like them too. Trust me.
Professor Sam McConkie, public health expert. I was wondering, Sam, what chance you were going to have of getting a day or two off COVID duty, but you're not in here with us in studio because you are isolating.
Well, one of my family contacts over Christmas is having a test this morning, so I'm feeling fine, but he had some symptoms, so he's off getting a test on, so I didn't want to go spreading it around. There's a time not to spread this, and this is it. So I didn't have so many calories. It was more protein. There was a lot of pig. There was a lot of turkey eaten. As I said, I think it's about four goes, and then lots of nibbling in between, which I really enjoyed.
You have had a good look at the papers this morning and most of these vaccine-related headlines. What do you make of the... Well, we go to the Sindo first, Sam. Delivery of hope.
I think it's fantastic. I think it's just a great place to be in with the vaccine story. It's happened much, much quicker than certainly I'd imagined and most people had imagined. And here we have not just one vaccine license, but there are about three others hopefully coming in the wings that will give us more doses quicker. And now we're actually in this wonderful challenge of how to roll it out quickly to the most vulnerable. And I like the plan, this idea of going to nursing homes where the most vulnerable are and vaccinating the staff and the residents there seems to me like a very practical, feasible way to start over the next few months.
Are we getting the tone of the coverage right? Not just in the newspapers, but us broadcast journalists as well, because, you know, given what we don't know about this vaccine and what it is going to do, particularly in terms of transmission of the virus, might it not be better to tell people, well, you know, we're going to have to hedge our bets here, folks, and just wait and see?
So I think there's different attributes of a vaccine. One that quite rightly concerns people most is it safe? And because these vaccines have been tested in very large numbers, 30 to 44,000 people, and they have a safety database that's gone to our regular regulators in the EU and obviously in the US and in Britain as well. And they've said, yes, this looks very safe. That is profoundly reassuring. So I think on the safety message, we've got very strong and powerful messages. Many products just get into licensing with safety data on 5 or 10,000 individuals, whereas this, as I said, is 30 to 40,000. So I think we can very, very confidently say this is a safe product. It's clear that the Pfizer vaccine prevents mild and moderate illness in young, healthy people. Now, of course, mild, moderate illness isn't what we worry about. It's death in the 90-year-olds. So how sure are we that it will be 90% effective at preventing death in 90-year-olds? We don't quite know that yet, but it seems like it will prevent mild and moderate illness and probably some death. So I think there's a time you have to move ahead with knowledge of safety, confidence in safety, and some very strong evidence of it preventing mild and moderate disease, mm-hmm. and a pointer towards preventing death. So I feel this is a time for celebration. It's New Year, it's Christmas, we need some hope. So I wouldn't fault a little bit of hysterical hopefulness at this stage. We actually need a message of hope. This is the right message now for Christmas and New Year. The days are getting longer, the sun is shining, the storm is over, and the vaccines are on the way.
Sorry.
I think we all need a bit of hope.
Who are you and what have you done with Sam McConkie?
Yes, people are normally thinking I'm very sad. Well, I know. I roll out the pessimist. Get on, Sam.
All of which is very reassuring. All of which is very reassuring, Lise, to the people who are going to believe the message around the vaccine. But then there are obviously large numbers that won't. Eilish O'Hanlon in the Indo, page 26 there, is writing that we're back to stoking fear to ensure COVID compliance. Is she right? Is there any other way?
Well, I just think
I was going to let Lise in on this. Sam.
Sorry.
It's interesting because I think that you yourself and Sam touched on something that's really, really important. And I've actually been, for the last 3 months, I've been working on a kind of a project to do with disinformation, fake news. And a lot of my time has been spent looking at anti-vaccine sentiment and anti-vaccine messages and so on. And it is quite staggering how deep and how far into the online community the anti-vax messages are spread out. They're disseminated everywhere and they take many different forms and very, very many different guises. And I think that as well as the rollout of the vaccine, it is so crucial for the government to get it right. I think equally crucial is the rollout of the message that that this vaccine is safe, and a debunking of all the myths surrounding not just the COVID vaccine, but vaccines in general. I think this is a unique chance to literally rewire people's brains about vaccines.
When you are chasing your tail, correcting all of the mistakes that people are deliberately putting out there, you're not setting out your own agenda, are you?
Well, you see, this is it, because I think that an awful lot of the disinformation, I know we're going a little bit off topic, but a lot of disinformation, it starts online and it often takes journalists and, say, media outlets a while to pick up what is out there. And I think what needs to be done is finding, and there's a difference between people who are nervous about a vaccine and vaccine hesitancy. That's understandable. You know, people are looking, my God, this is a new medicine. You know, is it OK? But then there are the anti-vax brigade who are going, there's, you know, there's weed killer in this. There's microchips in this. They're going to surveil you, you know, through the vaccine. There's, you know, there's all kinds of poisons in this, and you know,
tinfoil hat nonsense. Yeah,
but you know what? It gets a massive pickup online, and it's in closed groups where people have been told this, and they're getting the messages from God knows where, and it's really sinking in. And I think that in order to roll out a campaign, you've got to start at the very beginning and literally debunk everything, explain how vaccines work, explain how these vaccines work because they're new, and get at people who are genuinely been fed bad information by bad actors. I mean, this isn't just your next door neighbour going, oh, Jesus, you know, Minnie told me that if I get this, you know, I'm going to go three arms. These are people who are really trying to disrupt the vaccine programme. And this, I cannot, you know, just having spent the last few months looking at this, it is the campaign to get people to take up of this is absolutely vital.
I couldn't agree with Lise more. And actually, no disrespect to you, Philip, when you say tinfoil hat wearing crazy people, it kind of diminishes the seriousness of the row. And I know you didn't mean to do that. But the reality is that these people have, like, they're malevolent and they're operating in spaces that we don't normally see. And I think that's why when the messaging is being done, it has to be done in the places where it needs to be heard most. And I'm talking about the echo chambers that most of us are very unfamiliar with. And I wouldn't have a huge degree of confidence that the apparatus of the state and the government are sufficiently tuned in to where these messages are being spread to such terrible effect. Like, there's a platform that was set up arguably to counteract the liberalism of Twitter called Parler. I'm not sure if you're on Parler. Now, I joined Parler a couple of weeks before the US presidential election, just to see the nature of the conversations that are happening on that particular platform. And for some inexplicable reason, I set it up so that my phone gets alerts every time some of the people I follow on Parler post something. And I can't for the life of me figure out how to turn it off, which means that 24 hours a day, I'm being bombarded by the craziest nonsense that you could possibly imagine. And all of these people are agreeing with each other. And they are all doing it to spread a message of disinformation for, you might have a better insight as to why this is being done, because it's really, really troubling. And the government and governments across the European Union are not very good at that. And when we saw that in Brexit, we saw that with the whole Cambridge Analytica, the manner in which it derailed the Brexit debate. Yeah. And that kind of social media menace is what we have to be really combating now.
I analysed some of the vaccination-related stuff on TikTok recently, and the positive messages about what the vaccine can do that are sort of being put out there by influencers who are working in conjunction with government are outnumbered by the anti-vax stuff by a factor
of
8 or 10 to 1. Sam, when you see this stuff filtrating from the online sphere into mainstream media, are you like the poor man driven demented trying to correct the internet until the wee small hours of the morning, or do you let it pass?
Not really. I suppose I see that number of things I comment. One is that there are about three concrete ways out of this COVID-19 mess pandemic. One is the New Zealand one, which I've been advocating for, is zero COVID, and we clearly haven't gone down that route in Ireland. And the second is an effective vaccination, and the third is an effective small molecule like remdesivir, which, you know, we don't have an effective small molecule yet. So we've got to turn folk who are against something and ask, what are you for? It's a bit like, I'm obviously from Ulster, and Paisley used to say, Ulster says no, but the question is, what does he stand for? So we've got to turn the question around and say, what are you advocating for? Are you advocating for anything useful here? And in my view, there's only four options. One, stay in this mess, which none of us want. Two is a zero COVID. Three is an effective vaccine. And four is an effective small molecule.
Sam, they are four things that are nebulous, but nonetheless attractive. Words like freedom, words like safety. And it's really rather hard, isn't it, at the level at which you're speaking to counteract those messages.
I see part of it is some of the folk that are in this, unfortunately, have sort of lost a broader trust in society. They've lost a broader trust in institutions that many of us believe are the mechanisms by our liberal democracy gives us a better life and brings us a better life. Some of it, as we've just heard, is almost nefarious, not just from Cambridge Analytica, but from bots, from maybe countries and individuals and nations that don't want essentially liberal democracy to flourish and survive. So a lot of what's driven on my view on social media is actually coming from alternative ways of seeing the world that want to destroy ours. So I think we have to see it for what it is. And, you know, we've seen that in the British Brexit thing, we've seen US elections. There's no doubt that information is really power, and being able to drive that public information forum, which is something we take pride in our liberal democracy, is this idea that, you know, I can walk up and down the street and more or less have relatively free speech with relatively few restrictions. I can criticize the government. To me, it's important that we have a world that we can continue to do that. And that commitment to openness, transparency and free speech to me is a valuable attribute of our society. But it's the old paradox of liberalism. How do you tolerate the intolerant? So we've got this very vocal group that are intolerant of others and almost shutting down debate just by force of numbers. Truth is not a democracy. If it's 8-1, that doesn't mean that the 8 are right. You know, that's just something that most of us realize. So I think it's learning to find mechanistic ways of tolerating and even cherishing diverging voices when they're open to listening to others. The problem is when the other diverging voices sort of swamp the debate and kind of prevent debate and close down debate by overwhelming other voices, then that's very divisive in my view and very, very wrong and very unhelpful.
Back to the papers. I want to take a look at Tony O'Brien, the former head of the HSE, in the Sunday Business Post. In his final paragraph, Lise, he says, "And it really is time to seriously engage with a zero COVID-19 strategy, ideally for the island, but certainly for the Republic. The government has treated Neffert's advice as though it were a tasting menu and used it like an incomplete course of antibiotics, creating resistance with no cure effect. Now it's time to take the strong medicine." Is there any indication that the government is going to do anything other than continue to perform this balancing act between the scientific and the industrial / commercial advice?
No, I don't think there's any indication of that at all. I think that the zero COVID option, I mean, it's, you know, it would just be too dramatic, I think, for the government, because it would require far too many, literally the shutting down of a country. And, you know, unlike, you know, New Zealand gets trotted out a lot, but, you know, New Zealand is different. It's not in a member of, you know, a nation of, united nation of other countries. It doesn't have the same sort of literally amount of traffic going through. There's all, you know, open borders, all that thing. But we've seen, I mean, in a funny sort of way, the tensions between the coalition partners, between Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens, they sort of pivoted during the year. So they stopped sniping at each other and they started sniping at Neffert, because it became sort of the government versus Neffert. And once the initial alarm of the first lockdown was over, when everybody was in it together, and then it became much more complicated coming out of the first lockdown, was much more difficult and complex than going into it. And of course, there was the transition of it into a new government here as well. And all the rocky start of that, then they sort of coalesced together around the pushback against Neffert. And, you know, Neffert are looking at the scientific data. They're looking at the figures. They're looking at the R numbers. They're looking at the, you know, the hard data. Whereas the government are looking at businesses, the economy, the political ramifications, what it means for the border, trying to figure out how we fit into Brexit. It's never going to be a fit. And I don't think the government are ever going to embrace Neffert's desires, and ever. It's not going to happen. This will carry on. This pushback against each other is going to carry on until we come out some kind of the far end in some shape or form.
But yet, Conor, looking at page 2 of the Sunday Times, there is an appetite in the public for starting to think about doing things differently. Mandatory vaccination wins support from the public.
Yeah, there's a broad acceptance that there are certain cohorts of people that will need to be vaccinated. And the people in healthcare settings is obviously one cohort. People in schools. And, you know, I think people are moving towards an acknowledgement that if we are to get through this, there does need to be a high uptake in the numbers taking the vaccines. And I think everyone would be loath to suggest that you'd have to have mandatory vaccines, because you can't really do that. You can't strap someone to a gurney and inject them with the vaccine. That would just be absurd. But what you have to do is incentivize people to get the vaccines in whatever way possible. So, for instance, there's a huge acknowledgement that if you want to travel on a plane, if you want to international travel, you'll have to have a vaccination cert. And some people are saying, oh, no, that can't be done. Well, I'm sorry, it's being done across Africa already, because there are countries in Africa like Liberia, Sierra Leone, Ghana, where you can't go into the country unless you have a cert to prove that you have a vaccination for yellow fever. So this isn't new. Requiring somebody to have a piece of paper to say they've been vaccinated from COVID-19 6 months, a year down the line, I think it should be essential. And I think we have to be giving people incentives and encouraging them, and indeed putting pressure on people to get vaccinations in key settings. For instance, mumps. Those are in that piece in the Sunday Times, they're talking about the increase in the incidence rate of mumps, because the anti-vaxxers are suggesting that the mumps vaccine is in some way damaging to the civic world in which we live. It's nonsense. But, you know, does that mean that a child needs to have a cert to prove they've had the MMR before they can go to a creche? I would argue that if you want the benefit of going to a creche, well, then that comes with a responsibility.
Yeah, but the flip side of that is that you then end up running the risk of excluding those people who most need public health outreach by not bringing them into settings like creches where they can be persuaded of the benefits.
Yeah, but it is about, as I say, persuasion, education, and incentivization. And that, like, there's no...
But punishment and persuasion are almost contrary opposites.
But at the same time, if you can't get the MMR, if you have a baby under the age of 6 months who can't get vaccinated, or under a year who can't get vaccinated, other babies, other children who don't get the vaccination are putting the baby who physically can't get it yet at risk. So, you know, there has to be a degree of responsibility shown by parents of young children when it comes to childhood vaccinations. But actually, we're moving away from... The reality is we're talking about COVID-19. Okay. And what we have to do is we have to get to a place where the vast majority of society recognise the fact that the vaccinations are safe, they work, and they will get us out of this unholy mess that we're in.
Let's leave that there for the moment, because after the break I want to, for the last time ever in 2020, talk about Brexit.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
So one more time with feeling then, folks. Is the absence of a hard Brexit the worst thing that's ever happened to you, Connor?
I'm absolutely thrilled, because I've been...
But you must have had all of those "what do we do now" articles for the whole of 2021 written, no?
No, actually, I mean, there's been a lot of rewriting of articles over the last couple of days. For instance, I wrote a big piece about the sales on the 23rd of December, 22nd of December, which had to be entirely scrapped come the 23rd of December, because the government announced that there would be no sales. So I've written the pieces about what happens to your Amazon.co.uk shopping in the event of a no-deal Brexit. And of course, that's not going to happen now either. Fingers crossed, hopefully. So I don't think we can celebrate the deal. I think it's really... And I think Fintan O'Toole has a really strong piece in The Observer today.
Yes.
But I don't think this is anything to celebrate. It's a terribly sad event.
Yeah, let's talk about Fintan's piece in The Observer, an opinion piece, in which he says, look, naturally... of course it's going to be the case that a divorce or a breakup is going to be the thing that characterises a relationship. But we should think back on 50 years in which the EU shaped Britain and Britain shaped the EU, and it's all quite positively.
Yes, I mean, this is the point. It's that it is easy just to focus on. I mean, the last 4 years have been so bitter, they've been so full of chaos and confusion and finger pointing and so on, that it's very easy to concentrate on that and have our overview shaped by that. But, you know, when you look back, at sort of the history of Britain and the EU, while there is a huge amount of Euroscepticism that has always sort of run like a big vein through a lot of the British politics, I mean, interestingly enough, among the papers released in the archives today, there's a piece which talks about Thatcher's conversations with Charles Haughey and how she was complaining about how, you know, the Germans were trying to sort of control everything, and all her wariness about, you know, the EU coming to control more of British laws and sovereignty. I mean, it's interesting that you go back to that. But at the same time, there's a lot of positive as well. You know, there's a lot of positivity as well. You know, going back to what the, you know, the, what the British did in terms of shaping some of the larger views, even though, as Fintan points out, some of the things like, you know, pushing the single market agenda and so on, they didn't really understand at core, he says, what that would actually imply in terms of the breaking down of barriers, you know, between the different EU countries and so on. So while it's sometimes, the British were quite proactive, they also didn't understand that at the same time they were proactively basically pushing some agendas, that this was just feeding the fires of the never really, absent Brexiteer feeling and sentiment in Britain as well. So, he sort of says we should be kind and not just sort of, think that they're all members of, flaming members of the ERG and so on, and that we need to look at it over the context of the last 50 years. But I think it's going to be very difficult for the bitterness that the last 4 years, he says, we should look past it. I think it's going to be very hard for that bitterness to subside. I think it'll be a long time before there's complete trust between the two nations and the two governments again. That's my own.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. But I think the two things that he cites, the two ways that Britain really helped the European Union were, as you say, the single market and enlargement. And the enlargement piece was incredibly important because both Margaret Thatcher and then Tony Blair were very anxious to enlarge the European Union. And obviously the single market, which is the European Union's perhaps greatest achievement because it has taken away all the friction that would have been associated with trade. You know, that wouldn't have happened without Britain. But he's also pointing out in the piece that Britain benefited hugely from its membership of the European Union, and it allowed it move from its imperial past, which it had lost by the early 1970s. So it allowed it to shed that imperial cloak and move forward into a future when it was central to a new European project. And the great tragedy is that Britain has turned its back on that. And the great tragedy, Philip, is that it has turned its back on it for the most nebulous of reasons. And because, effectively, and we, like, without going back over the Brexit referendum, the British people were so effectively and consistently lied to. And as a result of that, we will now all mourn the passing of Britain as a member of the European Union. And it is really sad, and it's not something to celebrate. And the deal, while it was essential, it's another sad moment in our 21st century history.
I'm joined on the line by John Rentoul, Chief Political Commentator for the London Independent. John, my cursory examination of your press this morning, I don't see an awful lot of those very prominent Brexiteer voices out endorsing this deal. I presume, though, that with Labour support, it is going to pass Parliament.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's no question about that. It would pass Parliament anyway, because I don't think there's any sign of significant opposition from the Conservative Eurosceptics. They say they're going to look at it, and they've got the laughably entitled Star Chamber of lawyers, Eurosceptic lawyers, who are going to scrutinise the deal in detail. But politically, they've got nowhere to go. They have their Prime Minister telling them to vote for this deal, and I think almost all of them will do so.
If I could be so bold as to try and sum up the attitude of the press here, today anyway, towards this deal, it would be largely one of the kind of regret that you've been hearing there from Lise and Connor, but also a hope now that our nearest neighbour is able to make a success of this, that there are sunlit uplands and splendid isolation ahead for you, because we don't want a cranky and cantankerous Britain on our doorstep. Is there a sentiment, is there a strong feeling of, yes, we can do that now, we have won a workable deal?
Yes, I think there is. I mean, I think the it's hard to sum up a national mood, but I think the mood in the UK is fairly pragmatic, accepting that Boris Johnson has actually made a reasonable compromise here. I mean, my own paper, The Independent, has welcomed the deal, obviously, as preferable to a no deal outcome, but also pointed out that in many ways, the deal is reinventing the wheel of European cooperation, because it just reinvents many of the structures and arrangements that we had in the European Union, but just at a slightly arm's length distance. I mean, I remember my colleague Hamish McRae once suggested that the UK would move from being half in the European Union to being half out. And I think that's roughly where we are. I think we're actually going to remain quite close to the European Union, and it's important that we've done that while remaining on reasonably good terms at a leadership level.
Yeah, speaking of leadership now, look, he's still a figure of fun on this side of the Irish Sea, but is Boris Johnson due some kudos today? Because he has done what nobody else in British politics appeared able to do.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I take my hat off to him. I think it's an astonishing achievement. And, it automatically puts him in the pantheon of British prime ministers who've achieved something consequential, whether you agree with it or not. I mean, he is up there with Ted Heath, who took us in, Margaret Thatcher, who reformed the EU, and as many people have pointed out, helped build the single market. You know, Harold Wilson was able to hold that referendum in 1975 to keep us in. That was a significant political achievement. And now Boris Johnson's got Brexit done, which is what he said he would do. And, people will criticise it. But, I mean, it is a significant historical achievement.
And did he do it by grinding out a scoreless draw with the EU, or are there clear wins that he's going to be able to point to in the days ahead?
Well, I think on any balanced assessment, the UK has given in to a large extent on fish. But the point is that any gains for our fishing industry, any gains at all on the status quo are going to be welcome. But we have given up on our ambition just to sort of get. I mean, this ludicrous notion that we don't want any foreign ships in our economic zone is just absurd. But I think the gain of tariff-free access to the single market, admittedly with checks at the border, but I mean that's inevitable because of what Boris Johnson wants. But I mean, the access to the single market is a huge gain, and I think both sides will be satisfied with that.
John Rentschel, thank you very much. Connor, on that point that he mentions there, Michael Brennan has a good piece, page 7 of the Business Post, about the revenue ramping up preparations for Brexit. Lots of red tape stories for you to write about in the coming weeks.
Yeah, no, it'll be like that's the reality of it, that, you know, the tariffs have been avoided and there isn't going to be any of those taxes and duties that people would have been fearful of. But there is still going to be a huge amount of red tape, and it's going to create log jams at ports. It's going to create log jams at airports and at postal depots. And there's no way around that now, because the UK has left the European Union, and while it won't be treated as a so-called third country, so it won't be treated like China and the United States when it comes to trade, there is still going to be paperwork, and it's going to create difficulties. It's also probably going to create delays, but the flip side of that is it might see more Irish consumers making the very conscious choice that they've made so far in 2020, which is to spend more of their money in Ireland. And of course, within the European Union zone, because if you can avoid all those complexities and complications by shopping locally or by shopping in Germany or Spain or France, people might make that choice. And ultimately, the people who lose out there will be the UK traders.
And is that it, Lise Hand? And with that, are we done with Brexit? I remember one of my senior colleagues
never
in
say
here
that, fella, please.
two years ago saying with a sigh, I said, I'm going to be doing Brexit stories for the rest of my career. Can we put it to bed now, or do you think that this is a dynamic process that's just going to keep on popping up?
I think it will keep popping up. I would love to sit here and say, we here's your hat, what's your hurry, and shove it out the door and sing Auld Lang Syne at the same time. But I don't think so. I mean, it's been an extra. I mean, funny enough, I was in London covering the referendum when it all went sideways in the summer of 2016, and my last time out of this country was I was in London when they officially left at the end of January of this year. And I remember at that stage thinking, God, that's done and dusted now. They just have to, dot a few I's and cross a few T's and the job is oxo. And here we are, the sweat of our brow.
Next posting is going to be to Rockall.
Yeah, I mean, that was some year, because 2016, because I was also in, a few months later, I was there for the Trump victory. So I was in shock for the rest of 2016 after those two. But I think that the sense of relief in government is enormous, because they were, despite all the documents were prepared and, you know, everything, everybody saying, no, we know that a no deal is a possibility. I don't think anybody would have been ready enough for a no deal. It would have been catastrophic. So I think the sense of relief around government buildings this Christmas is absolutely enormous. They know that it will pop up. There's going to be flare-ups when somebody says, I didn't realise we signed up to that. And there'll probably be a few rows. But I think overall, yeah, the heavy lifting is done.
And of course, there was a piece by Hugh O'Connell in the Sunday Independent, quoting the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, pointing out that the door isn't entirely closed on Britain coming back into the European Union.
Not in our political lifetimes.
I would
now.
Say a lot of people are going, just hold, yeah, stall the ball there on that one.
Insofar as it affects academia, Sam McCrunky, I noted that there was a story yesterday, quite a generous story on the part of the Irish government, continuing to pay for or going to pay for Erasmus students from Northern Ireland to travel to wherever they want in Europe. 650 a year, well, it was certainly last year anyway. Are you worried by the effects that Brexit is going to have on the exchange of ideas within the scientific community?
So there's a very, very long tradition of hundreds of years of scholars travelling between colleges, and I'm sure that will continue. So we have external examiners, often from Northern Ireland and from Britain, and I'm sure that will continue. Where it's a bit more tricky is mutual recognition of professional credentialing. So if somebody qualifies as a surgeon with RCSI in London, do those qualifications automatically now transfer into Ireland or other EU countries? I don't believe those details have been worked out in detail yet. I'm hoping that good sense will prevail and people like physiotherapists and airline pilots and other professional qualifications can be mutually recognised, as they have for the last 50 years. But those things have really yet to be worked out in detail.
One of our texters wants you to answer a question, Sam, on vaccine shopping or vaccine choice. They said, can we have a choice in them? Can we have the one that Philip or the Prof gets? Are they all the same?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. Thanks for asking that. So we've one vaccine on the market now that's legal to give, so there's no choice right now. But I really strongly expect that we'll have between 3 and 5 options available to us within 4 to 6 months. And that's a wonderful place to be. When the more details of research from phase 3 studies come out, we'll find probably that some work better, for example, in children under 2, some work better in younger people, some work better in 90-year-olds. We might find that another one is better at preventing transmission, what's called a transmission blocking vaccine. And even though it may not prevent so much disease and death, it prevents the infection spreading to others. So obviously healthcare workers and those working in nursing homes, whose main risk is not only to themselves but actually in transferring the as a vector of the virus to other people that they're caring for, those transmission blocking vaccines would be much better for those of us who are more worried about transmitting it rather than actually dying from it. So over the next 6 months, I'm hoping get a lot more of this nuanced detail about specific characteristics of the different products, and then it will be a case of targeting appropriately the vaccines that suit best each individual group.
Okay, let's leave that there for the moment. I want to go back to Brexit just one second, because as John Rentoul mentioned, the fisheries aspect of the deal proved to be one of the most sticky. I'm joined on the line by Patrick Murphy, CEO of Irish South and West Fish Producers Organisation. Pat, we're seeing headlines in the UK media today that UK fishermen are feeling betrayed by this deal and you are feeling betrayed by this deal. Is it possible that there are two groups of losers in this?
Well, we definitely are going to be losers anyway, because you see, the common fishery policy was designed on relative stability, and that was to protect the coastal communities and the sustainability of the stocks that everybody's trying to catch, Philip. So thanks very much for putting me on the airwave here and give another side of this. And our side is that we are the bargaining chip for to get this deal across the line with the last 5%. And we feel very aggrieved. Just to give you, the listeners, a couple of understandings of where we're coming from. So our hake, and everybody knows what hake is, the European tack where we fish is 63,000 tonnes. We get 3,500 tonnes. The UK are looking for an increase in their share out. And they're currently at 13.6%, 11,000 tonnes. They're hoping to actually go up 150% of what we catch for our entire fleet. So I don't think that's a bad deal. The same with monk, with mackerel, and every other species. And somebody has to pay for this price. And the price we will be paying is not just with fish. It'll be paying with jobs. So generations of fishermen who have risked their lives to go to sea to earn their living and support their coastal communities are going to be adversely affected by this.
And Pat, and, as you say, the Common Fisheries Policy set out the sustainability targets for fishing in the past. In UK waters now, will it be a free-for-all for British registered boats, or is there agreement on how to manage the stocks?
Well, I was told today that there was three Spanish-flagged UK vessels landing into Dingle this morning. So for them, it's business as usual, only they're going to have more fish to catch, and we're not going to get that fish. So it won't be a free-for-all. There's loads of complexities, Philip, that we won't go into this radio show. You'd be looking for a couple of hours, like a multi-annual plan. So there's all different rules and regulations that govern our fishing outside in the water. But the main one is quota share. And we, in Ireland, have a very poor quota share, as I said. So relative stability is no longer the way that the European Union has decided.
Are you looking for a compensation package then, Pat?
No, we're looking to be treated the same as the UK. It's like this. If a plan that has been there since 1973 has been completely and utterly altered under relative stability, and one country now we're going to get an increase of 25% of the fish stocks, then that means somebody else has to lose it. So obviously, for me anyway, it means the plan has to change. So the European Union now have a decision to make with the Common Fishery Policy. Are they going to use zonal attachment, which is the reason why the UK have demanded this fish and got it? And are they going to apply that same rule going forward to the Irish fishermen and our zonal attachment? Like, you look at the map that we sent into the RTE, and who is going to be the greatest contributor now of fish stocks and fishing grounds and the fish to the European Union?
It will be it's Irish Ireland. Waters. Okay.
So surely be the God that should be reflected in the future negotiations, and our department and our minister and our Tánaiste live up to the promises that they made, and to keep jobs in our coastal communities. Look, just quick fact. We've already paid the price in my lifetime where 42% of our boats over 60 feet have been wiped out, eliminated, gone, never again to be seen in the water. 42%. We're down to 164 boats. In my estimation, we might lose another 64 if this goes ahead, if we lose the fish stocks, because they just won't be able to make a living. Whereas if they apply relative stability rules where we get back some of our fish, just like the UK, we might be able to hold on to those boats.
Okay.
And I think as a country that's giving this fish and the fishing ground to the European Union, surely that's a fair ask.
All right. Patrick Murphy, CEO of Irish South and West Fish Producers Organisation. Thanks.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're very...
Now, listening to that promo there, in spite of Joe Duffy's attempts to kill Dermot Kennedy's career, you were making a point, Connor.
Yeah, it's the first Irish artist to be number one for Christmas, I think, in close to 20 years. And I think it's directly attributed to the fact that X Factor wasn't on this year.
Because not including those Irish people who were in the X Factor acts. But
X Factor destroyed the race for Christmas number one. And I just think, and that meant that we've been kind of frozen in time for our Christmas songs. I think Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas might have been the last one. So I think we might have a whole slew of new Christmas songs over maybe next year if X Factor doesn't get resurrected. So I think that's something to acknowledge COVID for. Because
Sunday Times page 6, Lise, a year to forget that we will remember forever.
Oh, yes. I mean, looking back over the year, I suppose it's just because COVID dominated everything that you forget there was other stuff going on as well. I mean, I really think most people really just want to get this year over and done with. They really do. There's a sense of just get into 2021 and let's just put this behind us. And, you know, quite a lot went on. I mean, politically, it was an extraordinary year. I mean, we had an extraordinary general election, which I have trouble believing it was this year. It was, you know, it seems like an aeons ago.
I was about to fact check you there, actually. Lise.
It actually was. So, you know, we had this extraordinary, you know, this extraordinary general election where, you know, this Sinn Féin did extraordinarily well. Then, you know, that sort of long hiatus as they tried to, as nobody wanted to go into government and, you know, as the pandemic arrived on our shores, and we all remember where we were when Leo Varadkar made his famous speech. And then, you know, the putting together of a government by, you know, a fairly reluctant bunch of people who weren't particularly happy to find themselves in bed together. You know, and then sort of the handover of power in the middle of the summer and the kind of ensuing madness where, you know, to lose one agriculture minister could be considered unfortunate, considered to lose two is carelessness. And then we had the sort of slow slide into the winter. And, you know, it has been it has been a sort of, you know, there's been quite a lot of extraordinary things going on politically, and they've just been completely overshadowed.
And just as things, those stories, negative stories about how all the parties are getting along with each other in government start to fade from the headlines, Conor, we get this sidebar in the Sunday Indo that I was talking about earlier on, that water charges should be explored, suggests junior Green Party Minister Malcolm Noonan.
Yeah, part of me would call this the most tone-deaf story of the year, because the last thing anybody wants now is for a resurrection of the water charges rows that cursed us for so many years. But I hate to say it.
But water needs funding.
Well, this is the thing, and my Twitter timeline is probably about to explode, but I think water charges are a good idea. And I think
you know what you're going to be doing for the rest of the day.
And there's a reason for that. I think from an environmental perspective, it makes sense that, you know, polluter pays and we pay for our usage of these things. It would have also delivered us a much, much higher level of water infrastructure that now has to come out of general taxation. And I think the problem, and I've said it in public on many occasions, the problem wasn't the water charges. The problem was how water charges were sold to us as a people. And it was considered a tax on water. And it's outrageous that we should be paying a tax on water, this free commodity that falls from the sky. The reality is we have to pay for this stuff. And this would have been an environmentally friendly and cheaper way to pay for our water. And if the water, if Irish Water had done its job properly, which it clearly didn't do, and if the government of the day had done its job properly, which it clearly didn't do, people would have understood that by paying water charges, we would have paid less for our water than we do today. And we would have had a better infrastructure than we do today.
And the other reality is that right now, Lise, somewhere there at home, there are Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael members of this government setting fire to their heads listening to Conor.
Oh, I mean, if Eamon Ryan thinks, you know, his suggestion of the reintroduction of wolves is bad enough, the reintroduction of water charges is a whole new level entirely. And I'm quite sure Micheál Martin is hyperventilating and blowing into a brown paper bag somewhere, you know, in his Cork home. This is the last thing that they wanted to rear their head at this particular juncture. There's no doubt about it. But, I mean, as Conor rightly pointed out, if you wanted to write a playbook on how not to introduce a new utility, the Fine Gael government at that time did. I mean, you had Phil Hogan coming on the heavy, you know, threatening to turn people's water down to a trickle if they didn't stump up, making an absolute hames of the collection of water charges to the extent that they literally dumped the whole steaming bag of ordure into the lap of the revenue and just said, you guys deal with it. And of course, anybody who sees an envelope with a harp coming through the door, by God, compliance went, you know, rocketed overnight. And, you know, but the whole thing was an absolute disaster because everybody just focused on, you know, the millions been spent on consultants and all that. I mean, it was, I remember sitting through the committees, the Oireachtas committees, you know, when they were all the various bodies were hauled in to account for themselves. And it was just, there were so many hapless performances. I mean, it really was dreadful. So I really think that if this notion was to be aired again, and it actually loops back to where we started, it goes back to an information campaign. It goes back to saying, here is a map of Ireland. Look at all those things. They're all the millions of leaks and that are could fill, you know, 2 billion.
And here's how much it's going to cost to repair them. Okay.
You know, so they got it arseways last time. So
there's no, they'd get it arseways next time as well, for sure.
Well, I feel bad. I have to say something that may give them the benefit of the doubt. At least. New government, new chance. All right, Sam. But take off the COVID hat for a second, if you would. Is there anything else that caught your eye in today's papers that's not either Brexit or virus related?
Well, I was interested in there's a spy story on a fellow called Blake, who was one of the sort of Cambridge Four greatest British spies ever, who managed to escape from British jail after being convicted of selling lots of secrets to the Soviets, has finally died at the good old ripe age of 98. So all that sort of Kim Philby stuff from the 50s.
This was George Blake. Did he ultimately end up defecting?
No. Well, he, I think, was one of the most effective double agents ever.
You know, he did end up in Russia.
And then was found guilty of it, put in a British jail, and then managed to escape from this British jail, which is sort of the ultimate triumph, if you like, for the spy, and then lived out his happy days in the Soviet Union. I mean, that's almost like out of a John le Carré sort of delightful spy novel that we've all sort of thought of, that old Cold War stuff, but it's still alive and he's still been living out. That's interesting. I suppose my comment would be on the year that's passed, reflecting on it in a broader way. I think there's a lot of really good things, shockingly, that we maybe have learned through 2020, despite all the horrors of COVID, particularly, you know, appreciation of maybe cleaners and bin men, particularly realizing, you know, the whole housing crisis and crowding and housing. I think we've now that's been Indeed. Highlighted in a way that we've all read. It's not just for COVID, but it's almost inhumane to be squashing people together. The whole digitalisation, we've now, at least in healthcare, speeded up. Phone consultations are now almost normal. They're paid for. And I think some of that will continue. A lot of the online retail will continue. A lot of the working from home will continue. People realize, why should we all squash together in a big office when we can actually be more productive while being at home? We've appreciation of nature. We were lucky. The weather in March, April, May was fantastic. We all enjoyed being outside. So we've got to just enjoy the outdoors, including our gardens. We're now growing herbs and broccoli and beetroot that we never did before, not to mention baking and yeast and flour.
Starting to feel guilty the more and more I listen to you, because I'm doing about maybe a half of these things. Sam, how did you personally cope with going from being shy, retiring and, dare I say it, almost unknown academic to somebody who is now something of a national figure and household name?
So I know I always portray myself as the academic for various reasons, but I'm really at heart a very busy hospital clinician, and I've been looking after people with kind of sepsis, HIV and TB for many, many years, and trying to explain in a human way to people who are very sick and in some cases dying and their families what they're going through in complex technical ways, but trying to find metaphors and ways of communicating that are accurate and yet also sensitive. And there are a lot of transferable skills I've discovered, whether it's talking to you or talking to others. And I suppose doing international health, I could kind of see what was coming in a pandemic, and I've been through a bit of Ebola and HIV and these things before. So that sense of predictability and being able to see what was likely to come has come relatively easy to me.
Have you become a bit of a lightning rod as well for those who don't accept what you're saying?
Well, that's okay. My view is, unless you're actually upsetting a few people, you're not saying anything useful at all. So I certainly don't try to keep all of the people happy all the time. I worked in Sierra Leone in the middle of a very, very dangerous civil war for a couple of years as a military surgeon type of doctor in the past, in 93, 94. And I regretted after that not speaking out more to the Red Cross, to the embassies, to the BBC, to tell the story of the victims at that stage. And that has inspired me to very much speak out and encourage me to actually tell the story as I see it. And so that's certainly experience working in Africa.
Doesn't it put it in its perspective, culture wars, when you've lived in a real war zone?
Exactly. So with a lot of people with, you know, bullet wound, fished out a lot of bullets and sewed on a lot of broken limbs and tried to get skin closure of these horrible wounds, and, you know, largely successfully. But that was in a much more fraught situation. There were bombs dropping that we could hear. There were injured people coming through the place we lived. And we ended up, it escalated so much, we had to close the hospital down. It was a place called Sarabu in southern Sierra Leone, run by the Holy Rosary Sisters. And we had to together close the hospital down, secure the assets, pay off the staff. So I've been through much bigger challenges than this, shockingly, at a personal level. And that has actually helped me a lot to sort of talk sense and say out the right thing during this time. I think it's been very tiring. I remember one day on Claire Byrne's show at 10 o'clock at night, I said to her I was really tired. She said, oh, what's going on? I said, oh, well, I did BBC London, you know, at 6:15 this morning. And she was trying to get me to perform against Kira Kelly at 11:30 at night that same evening, and was wondering why I was tired. Oh,
dance,
take some coffee,
dance,
we'll be
professor,
fine.
Dance to our tune. Any other stories catching your eye, Connor?
Well, we haven't talked about Trump yet, and the fact that Trump is
no, and it's
soon
an absolute bloody relief, isn't it?
But I think one of the really dispiriting and horrible things over recent days is just when you think he can't get any worse, he starts this raft of pardons of people who definitely do not deserve pardons. So there's the Blackwater security officials who were found guilty of mass murder in Iraq, killing children.
Who worked for the brother of his education
who worked for
secretary,
the brother,
Betsy DeVos.
Exactly. The people who lied for him to obscure and delay the investigations of Robert Mueller. His father-in-law, Jared Kushner's father. Mm. He apparently, there was a piece of research done by Harvard. 88% of the people he's pardoned thus far have direct links to Donald Trump.
And whatever about the pardon, he's also now threatening to, well, sorry, he hasn't threatened to veto yet, but he certainly hasn't signed the COVID relief bill.
Of course not. And then the worst thing is William Barr, one of his like most hardcore acolytes, is now gone, and there's fears that he's going to put pressure on Rosen, the acting Attorney General, to allow him to behave in a more appalling way for the next 3 or 4 weeks. So I think we just have to all sit tight.
24 days and counting.
Wait until January the 20th.
Well, I mean, I know that we're just coming up to 12 now. And
thank you for doing my job for me. Well done.
So I was going to say I will be very brief, which is unusual for me. But the thing I think that struck me most, Philip, about the front pages today was that they all had a positive story on it. You know, they talked about, you know, the vaccines are coming and, you know, maybe things aren't as bad. And I remember sitting in a studio just after the last lockdown with, it was either on this show or possibly Claire Byrne, and it was either with the great Sam or the great Luke. They're like Madonna, like they're known by their first names now. And whoever said that at that time, we're going to be waiting 4 years for a vaccine. And I remember leaving here and going out into my car and I just started crying. And like, it's very unlike me, you know, I'm a very positive person. And I thought, 4 years, we're going to be waiting for a vaccine. So I just think to get to this stage.
Absolutely, 100%.
To actually say the vaccines are in Frigis and they're in the country, I just think that is right. Absolutely brilliant.
And before anybody can ruin that note of positivity, I'm going to send you all on your way with the best wishes for 2021. Thank you all very much for joining me remotely and in studio this morning. Lise Hand, Conor Pope and Sam McConkie.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Thank you very much.